The next case on our calendar is 07-344, Cleveland Bar Association versus Howard Mishler. Mr. Potash, I think you're going to go first, is that right?
That's correct.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal purposes. Good morning, Your Honors, both here and afar, and may it please the Court, my name is Lester Potash, and I am here on the report of the Board of Commissioners on grievances and discipline that found Howard Mishler to have engaged in some misconduct and imposing a sanction of a 1-year suspension with 6 months stayed. On Mr. Mishler's behalf, we take issue with one specific provision or portion of the Commission's finding, but we join in the Commission and commend to this Court the recommended sanction. I submit, Your Honors, that the issue that we take with the Commission has to do with the phrase division of fees that the Board of Commissioners found Howard Mishler to have violated. The facts in this case really are not in dispute and really fall outside any of this Court's prior considerations of what constitutes a division of fees. And the purpose for this disciplinary rule is to prevent a lawyer from just shopping for clients and then sending them out elsewhere for the work to be done. That's really what that rule intends, and it's great purpose. The application as it applies in real life to Howard Mishler, and I dare say to many solo practitioners, has some very ominous consequences, because that's not what the facts in this case revealed. The facts in this case revealed that Howard Mishler was retained by a client. Howard Mishler did the work for the client. He filed the complaint. He prepared the pleadings. He did all the things that needed to be done. And he found himself in the real world situation that I find myself in today, that I'm here appearing before the Supreme Court of Ohio and I have another matter pending. I can get that matter continued because I can send the trial court a notice saying that this takes priority, or I can try to arrange for the matter to proceed in my absence by another attorney. And depending on what it is, may determine whether I should continue or I should have the matter proceed as scheduled.
Should the client have an opportunity to be advised of the fact that the lawyer that he or she has hired is not going to appear for them?
In general, yes. I mean, there are some exceptions of last-minute arrangements. I have clients that I cannot contact, whether they're homeless or have no phone or whatever. But under ordinary circumstances, certainly, the client should know and the client should consent. But that's not this case. Howard Mishler was not charged with that. He was charged with illegally dividing a fee because he paid somebody to sit in for him $20 plus expenses. And that's what I perceive to be the issue here, the phrase division of fee, as opposed to whether he had consent, whether it was in writing, whether it was reasonable, things of that nature. That wasn't what he was charged with. That really wasn't what was tried before the panel. It was because Mr. Mishler received a bill from this lawyer, and remember, this was a contingency fee nature. If Mr. Mishler recovers, he gets paid. It wasn't on an hourly basis, and the client was never billed for that limited pinch-hit appearance by the other lawyer. It was, please cover for me while I am engaged elsewhere. And this happens all the time. And if I have a colleague in my office covering something, in fact, we have a $20 bill floating around. Nobody ever spends it. She covers for me a hearing. I give her this $20 bill. It stays on her desk. I cover her for a hearing. She gives me $20. It's a game.
But she's in your office.
She is a colleague of mine who shares space as an independent attorney, not affiliated.
Another lawyer. With me. Okay, so you're saying that's similar to the situation.
It's identical. It's just that her location is a lot closer than the other lawyer. I just have to walk the next office down the hall. But the point is, Mr. Mishler was cited for having paid the $20. And that, I believe, under the circumstances of this case and in an interpretation of that DR, is not what the rules intended. In fact, the rules encourage people to try to make sure that they have this sort of coverage, that they have this sort of backup. And the current rules encourage this.
Counsel, so that we can understand what this oral argument is about, the differences between parties here today, you indicated you don't dispute the discipline that is recommended?
The 1-year suspension, 6 months stayed, and the conditions. Yeah. In fact, I recommended that, I believe, to the panel. And so I'm not, because there were other violations, again, some of which he stipulated to, some of which the panel found.
So we're here discussing only what our opinion would include as violations?
Yes, because if you say that he violated this DR, the ramifications that that would have on other lawyers in the state of Ohio, to me, is monumental.
All right, and as far as you know, disciplinary counsel is still recommending the same sanction that's recommended to us as well.
Oh, no. That's why they filed their objections.
All right.
No, I'll have
you're pretty
some
far
time.
Apart.
I hope to have some
All
time
right.
for that.
Yeah, you're pretty far apart, I think, aren't you?
Yeah, well, yes, we're fairly far apart. But the point is that as it relates to that one finding, to Mr. Mishler, with all due respect, I don't believe it makes a difference in the ultimate sanction. In my opinion, if he did, as said, illegally divide a $20 fee. But as it relates to the effect, the unintended consequences, let's say, the doctrine of unintended consequences, you pull that down, I don't know what to do. Because how am I going to get somebody an arraignment? I'm trying a case, and there's a person being arraigned 8:30 in the morning in room 12th floor, Justice Center. There are a number of people that are there every single day. I can call somebody, say, could you please, on my behalf, enter an appearance on the defendant's behalf, plead not guilty, waive the reading of the indictment, all the other, and then let me know to whom the case is assigned. If I were to give that person $20, according to this, I have now violated the disciplinary rule, because an arraignment is an important part of the criminal process. And if I don't appear and I have somebody else appear without the client's consent and make a reasonable fee and writing and all this other, I have to call my counsel to defend me against a claim that may be brought. And I think that that is not what this court intends.
Counsel, isn't one of the concerns here the client having an attorney that has been hired by that client? And if I understand it, we're talking about attending a deposition as well, which is a little different than just standing in for the attorney of record and maybe asking for a continuance or even appearing at an arraignment where there's only a not guilty plea being entered. But if we're talking about anything that's substantive done for the client, shouldn't the client have the call as to who is going to be representing him or her?
I'm not disagreeing. In theory, absolutely correct. However, in this case, first of all, putting it to the facts in this case, he wasn't charged with that. So there's a lot of discussion, but if you take a look at what he is charged with, it's the division of the fee. And if you don't find a division of the fee, the rest of that is not material. That's the key that I'm presenting to this court, is what constitutes a division of fee. Because you don't get to the rest of those three paragraphs until you get past the division of the fee. But as it goes to the other essence, the other aspects of your question, certainly a person should, the client should know and should be told ahead of time if possible. A deposition is clearly an important part. That doesn't mean, and again, there was nothing ever said that the attorney who attended the deposition was incompetent, incapable, or otherwise didn't do the job. There was no evidence to show that as a result of that deposition, the case went south. There's no evidence to show that the lawyer fell asleep. There's nothing, in fact, one of the complainants indicated, yes, he made some objections, he took me aside, we talked. It's not that he didn't act the part.
Was there any objection registered by the client to the other individual coming in?
I don't recall if Mr. Sasse remembers, he'll tell you. I don't recall that took place. He indicated that he was unaware and a little surprised and maybe a little disappointed. I don't recall that he said, I don't want this guy. So that's the best of my recollection. So, Your Honors, that's the part that we take issue, and I submit that's an issue of law.
May I ask a question on that? I don't recall seeing in any of the briefs whether or not there were any decisions as to what this definition means according to the facts that are laid out here from other states. I don't know if this was originally a part of the ABA's model rules or not. Were you able to find any decision that construed that definition anywhere?
No, and I'll be very candid. I really didn't look to other states. I should have. Maybe in hindsight, that would have been a good idea to see if other states have interpreted it. But I thought that, as I said, the issue of division of fee had to do with what was the fee and was it actually divided as referred or otherwise paid to another lawyer and on what basis? And as indicated in the brief, this is an overhead expense.
So we might still be able to find some guidance on that.
You're right.
Counsel, why does not King versus Housel govern here?
For a variety of reasons. If we first go with the former discussion, shouldn't the client know, should it be in writing, whatever, in Housel and King, client knew. Client was told by Housel that I'm going to retain another lawyer, I'm going to pay him money, and the client agreed. It wasn't in writing, but everybody knew it. The issue was between King and Housel. King says, I should get 10% of the contingency award. Housel says, I gave you some money, be gone. And it was between the two lawyers. Client had no dog in the fight. But more importantly, the principal question, in page 504 of the decision, the principal question raised by this case is whether an agreement between two attorneys, where one employs the other to help him or prepare a case for trial and promises to pay the employed attorney a percentage of the amount recovered, but fails to disclose the fee agreement to the clients as required by the disciplinary rule, is unenforceable. This court determined that you can't use the disciplinary rule as a shield between lawyers. It had nothing to do, although, and I will say that the first paragraph of the syllabus, reading it, doesn't help me much. But candidly, it doesn't apply to my case. I mean, it's a very broad prohibition and requirement, but if you take it fact-specific to this case, it really isn't applicable. The second paragraph is fine. There's no problem with the second paragraph. The first paragraph is the one, and maybe Mr. Sasse will tell you why it is a great paragraph.
Do you think that the contingency issue in King and versus Housel, the allegation that there was a payment that was going to be made that took the form of a contingency, it would be the difference, I guess, in or a distinction between this case and the arrangement or alleged arrangement in Housel. A $75 an hour fee for doing the prep work, it hourly times the number of hours is one thing, but the nebulous 10% of a recovery is quite a different thing when you're talking about disclosure to a client.
Correct. And part of that in the discussion talks about future versus past. And if this were brought as a disciplinary case, as opposed to a civil suit, that probably would be a critical factor in bringing, as a rule then, it had been since modified, but as a rule was written, that may be a factor. In this instance, though, the focus is what was divided, what fee was divided. And in this instance, there was no fee. It was an overhead expense. He was going to recover money, but the bill was paid win, lose, or draw. And the same can be if it were an hourly contract or if it were for by the job. If the client is going to be billed for that lawyer's services, the client needs to know. If I, and I don't do this, maybe I should, but if I hired somebody to research and write briefs for this court and paid that attorney money, must I disclose that to the client? Or is that an improper division of fee, or is that my overheads assumed? There's no difference in that, because if this court says that I must now disclose any monies that I pay to an outsider, then how is my payment to my staff, the secretary receptionist, or my chief of staff, or whomever it is, how's that not an illegal division of fee? The money comes to me as a result of payment of a fee. I now pay that out. Now, we distinguish one as overhead and the other one is division of fee. Again, I think that this case requires this court to sort of re-examine what a division of fee is and how it's applicable. Unfortunately, the clock hasn't moved, and maybe I still have 15 minutes. I don't know how much time is left. But
well, we have a little problem with our clock this morning.
All right, well, I'll continue as if I have 15.
You have 47 seconds remaining.
Well,
you may want to save a little time, Mr. Potash.
I don't, in 47 seconds, don't believe I can adequately explain why it is that, as this court indicates, you don't second-guess the commission. But as you well know, three members of the commission saw the people. They disbelieved. They believed. They made their findings to the whole 28-member panel commission, who then evaluated this, and this 28-panel commission members that you appoint, as you well know, are judges and lawyers and educators and humans, non-lawyers. And they took into consideration all aspects, all 28 of them took into consideration the aspects of this situation.
You have 8 seconds remaining.
31, practiced since 1971, no prior discipline, his admissions, his cooperation, all this other, and his acknowledgement, I gotta do something better with my accounting system. And they came up with this proposal. I submit that from a real world standpoint, under these circumstances, it was the right one. And I ask this court to adopt its recommendation imposing the one-year suspension with the 6 months date on conditions. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Potash. Mr. Sasse.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Ben Sasse, and I represent the relator, Cleveland Bar Association. This case requires the court to determine the appropriate sanction for misconduct, including entering into a settlement agreement without client authorization, retaining settlement funds to cover up that settlement agreement, and misrepresenting to both the client and the Bar Association the fact of the settlement agreement, the status of the case, to conceal the fact of the settlement agreement and the retention of the settlement funds.
So, counsel, I gather that the point that Mr. Potash spent so much time on, the fee division versus overhead analysis, is not the pivotal point of the recommendation or the reason for the recommendation that the Cleveland Bar is pursuing.
That is correct, Your Honor. We believe that King versus Housel, as you were asking questions about during Mr. Potash's argument, does control on the division of fee issues, but it is not critical to the issue of what sanction should be imposed.
What do you say about the effect on the bar in general? If we uphold the finding that asking an attorney to substitute for you and paying an hourly fee to that attorney, whether you're successful in the case or not, not asking for additional fees from your client to cover that attorney's compensation, what does that mean for the rest of the bar if we find that to be a violation?
Your Honor, I mean, I think the problem is respondent is assuming that you can't do it. I think if you have a agreement, for example, a fee agreement up front, and I know in my firm we have fee agreements where we say the following two or three attorneys will be working on this matter. I will be primarily responsible, but from time to time, we may have other attorneys working on the matter. What the rule requires is disclosure and consent. If you inform the client in writing, look, I'm going to be handling your case, and then you list other attorneys or you list the issue and say, this attorney may cover at some point.
All right, but presuming that you have your solo practitioner or you find yourself in a high-volume criminal practice, which I think it happens quite a bit in that world, that you can't be two places at one time. You might have some kind of an arrangement with another solo practitioner who happens to be doing the same type of work. And it's not just, I'll do yours and expect you to cover mine. There might be some money exchanged there just in that arrangement. You're not bringing a client into your office and say, listen, I may be stuck for the hearing or whatever, and I'm going to hopefully get so-and-so to cover for me.
Right, Your Honor.
Does that automatically precipitate a violation? That's what I'm concerned about here.
I think what precipitates a violation is, in this context here, you have an attorney performing substantive work. He is performing that work, and there was testimony in the record to this effect, without any sort of control, any sort of oversight, any sort of control whatsoever. He was acting, Mr. Easel was acting, as the attorney on behalf of Mr. Walton during the deposition, for instance. And I think that is I don't purport to be an expert on criminal law, I think that is qualitatively different in terms of the amount of responsibility and the lack of oversight than coming to a court and giving an instructed plea or something along those lines. And I think the concern we have here is you have an attorney who is being paid to come in and take over the representation of a client during a deposition. And in an employment case, the plaintiff's deposition may very well make or break the entire lawsuit. And Mr. Walton testified that he was not comfortable. Now, I know there was a question concerning whether or not he objected. I don't think Mr. Walton objected. The record does not reflect that, but he was clearly uncomfortable with having this new person in here. He did testify that he did not feel that Mr. Easolt was prepared through the discussion that they had for about a half an hour before the deposition began, and that is our concern. You have an attorney here who has been hired by the respondent to come into the case to exercise independent judgment, to represent the client at what may be the most critical stage in terms of fact discovery in the entire lawsuit. And Mr. Walton was never informed of that, and he wasn't given an opportunity to object.
Did Mr. Mitchler have a written contract with the client in this case?
There are two grievances here, Your Honor. In the grievance brought by Frank Della Pola, which is the separate grievance, there were a couple written fee agreements. In this context, no. In terms of his representation of Mr. Mitchler's representation of Mr. Walton, which is the representation that involves the Mr. Easolt coming in and sitting through the deposition, there was no written agreement whatsoever.
But going to Justice O'Connor's question here, how it would affect other solo practitioners, would you say that a written agreement that would that would have a paragraph that would say, you know, if I have a scheduling conflict, the following attorneys may assist with the names listed, that would in essence tell the client in advance that there might be somebody pinch hitting in an emergency situation. Would that cover the situation here?
Exactly, Your Honor. We're not saying that you need to repeatedly consent to each and every time an attorney comes into court. We are saying that at some point in the process, the client should be informed that there may be another attorney coming in on his behalf, and he should consent to that.
And you also have to disclose how much you're going to pay them?
Yes, Your Honor,
in
you
advance?
Do. Yes, Your Honor, you do. And that can be important. If you look here, in any time you have, for example, the purchase of a product, you look in part to the price to determine the relative values of the product. If you look here, I believe in the report, it mentions that respondent at one point in trying to account for his fees in the separate action concerning Mr. Della Pola referred to the value of his services as $150 per hour. If you look to what Mr. Easolt is charging, he's charging $20 per hour. A layperson who may not understand the differences in experience and the differences in expertise between the two persons would probably be prompted by a difference of $150 an hour versus $20 an hour to go up to the attorney and say, hey, what is this? Who is this that you're going to get to represent me? And why should I agree with this representation? And so I do think it is important when you're looking at the issue to have a disclosure of the amount of the fee. And that's why we believe that the amount of the fee as well as the fact of the representation should be disclosed to the client. Now, the sanction recommended by the board in this case was a one-year suspension with six months stayed. We believe this court should reject the board's recommended sanction and impose an sanction of indefinite suspension for three reasons. An indefinite suspension accurately reflects the nature of the misconduct engaged in by the respondent in this case. An indefinite suspension affords appropriate weight to the aggravating circumstances that are present in this case. And an indefinite suspension is consistent with this court's prior opinions in similar cases. Focusing on the nature of the misconduct, what you have here is a situation where the respondent agreed to represent a grievant, Frank Della Pola, who had no prior experience with the legal system. He filed the lawsuit on his behalf in October of 2000. That lawsuit went through summary judgment phase. Summary judgment was granted against him, and that lawsuit was appealed. Around that time, Mr. Mitchler filed a separate lawsuit in federal court. By February of 2002, Mr. Mitchler had settled both cases. He settled both cases, and Mr. Della Pola was not aware of either of the settlements. And he did not send any letters. He did not send any sort of correspondence at all in the intervening 7 months to Mr. Della Pola to inform him of the settlements.
And what if my memory is correct, he settled for $7,500?
That is correct.
And he, Mr. Della Pola, paid $17,000 for legal fees?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Mr. Della Pola paid $17,500 for legal fees. And Mr. Della Pola testified at the hearing that when the $7,500 settlement offer was presented to him in mediation, the reason why he did not accept it is, in his words, why would I accept $7,500 when I paid over $17,500 in legal fees? And when Mishler accepted that settlement without his client's authorization, he did not inform Mr. Della Pola of it. He didn't inform him in February when he first did it. He didn't inform him in November when he sent Mr. Della Pola a letter that appears as Relator's Exhibit 44. In fact, what he did was he misrepresented the status of the case. He told Mr. Della Pola that he had been undergoing some sort of illness, and he said that the $7,500 settlement offer was still open. And he said, quote, the offer, hence the case, remains available through October 2002. Now, what does that mean? That means that he is telling Mr. Della Pola that his cases are still active, that he could still pursue them if he wished to do so, when in fact the case had already been settled and dismissed in both federal court and state court months before.
In his explanation later to the panel was that he could have reopened it? Did he make that kind of an explanation?
He made that kind of explanation, Your Honor, in an answer to the grievance that appears as Relator's Exhibit 11. Before the panel, he did not make that explanation. Before the panel, what he did was he denied, even though the letter was, and this goes part towards, respondents are saying that he cooperated, in the sense that he provided information when he was asked to do so, he may have cooperated. But the panel found that he did not make full and free disclosure, and he did not admit the nature of his wrongdoing. And what he did was, even though in Relator's Exhibit 11, he had attached that November 14, 2002 letter as an exhibit and incorporated it by reference, in fact, even though he admitted dictating that letter, even though Mr. Della Pola testified that he had received that letter, respondent denied sending it. And that was his explanation for why, for the statements in the letter. He said, I wasn't in my right mind at that time. I was ill. I dictated it, but I never sent it. Well, Mr. Della Pola testified receiving it. And in fact, Mr. Mishler had previously or had represented to the Bar Association in an answer to a grievance that he had in fact sent the letter and attached and incorporated that letter in the answer.
Explain the underlying claim that he filed for his client in state and federal court.
He filed employment discrimination claims, Your Honor. And unfortunately, while this isn't part of the violation we have alleged, he had his client pursue discrimination claims in state court and in federal court, but he neglected, or wait, no, I'm sorry, strike that. He was filing claims based on the fact that that he had to shave his beard. That was the nature of the dispute. It was not a strong claim at the outset. It was not a strong claim later on down the line. He said that
did the client, I've forgotten, it may be in there. Did he represent to the client that this was a strong claim, or was there any discussion of that?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, with respect to Mr. Della Pola, that there was a representation that it was a strong claim. There is a separate disciplinary violation that this court should also consider in determining the sanction with Mr. Walton. That violation relates to guarantees of between 70% and 90% of success.
Yeah.
And that violation with respect to Mr. Walton also involves
jumping back to the client saying, well, why would I settle for $7,500 when I've spent $17,000 on a lawyer? There's a simple answer to that is your claim never had any merit. And if you were foolish enough to pay your lawyer that kind of money, you ought to consider the $7,500 as money from heaven, which it probably was in this case. That doesn't excuse settling it without the client being informed and not telling the client about it. But it wasn't a bad deal, was it?
In terms of, no, Your Honor, it was not a bad deal in terms of the probable outcome of the case. But in terms of this particular client, this is not a sophisticated client. He had never filed a lawsuit before. He was not aware, as far as I know, of the lack of merit of his claim. What he knew was he was forced to pay $17,500 to pursue that claim. And that was also the subject of a finding of an excessive fee. And the problem here is Mr. Mishler did not spell out in detail what these payments were for, and that's the subject of conflicting evidence in the record as to the two fee agreements. In actuality, if you look at the payments don't follow any of the fee agreements. He paid $10,000 by February of 2001, and he paid all $17,500 by May of 2001. Now, if you look, what Mr. Mishler tried to argue is that there are three separate fee agreements. He said, I have a fee agreement for a $1,000 retainer, $10,000 costs for the state court lawsuit. I have a fee agreement, a $1,000 retainer, $10,000 costs for the federal lawsuit, and I have a fee agreement of a $3,000 flat fee for the appeal. But if you look at the time frame, the appeal was not filed until after, of course, the state court entered a summary judgment in June of 2001, and the federal lawsuit was not filed until June of 2001. So you're faced with a situation where he asked for and received the entire $17,500 before either of these other actions, which Mr. Mishler refers to in support of his fees, were ever filed. And indeed, the appeal couldn't have even been contemplated because the summary judgment had not been issued yet.
Mr. Sasse, your red light's been up. If you want to save any time for rebuttal on your
Yes, Your Honor.
You need to sum up quickly.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, I'll reserve the balance.
That's a good summation. Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Mr. Potash, you're probably not surprised to know that you've used your 15 minutes, but you may take 30 seconds.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, the sanction, which is the issue here and purpose of the rebuttal, since they filed the objection on the proposed sanction, has to do with viewing the individual as this court has done on many occasions. Clearly, this court has given some black law, black letter statement saying that if you do this, this will happen. If you take a look, whether it's Lexis or Westlaw, and you put in the specific code violation, and you put in sanction, you will find that this court has not hewed to that line without variation.
Why wouldn't an indefinite be the appropriate suspension, the appropriate sanction for a lawyer who settles a case without any authority from the client and then doesn't tell the client that the lawyer has done that for an extended period of time?
Because there's not just a direct cause and effect. There's a middle ground. And as this court has done, I used to use Glassman as the example. I think the more current one may be McRae. A woman gets money. She commingles it, told by a court, do not spend it. She spends it. She spends it for personal. She violates court orders. She commingles money. She does everything that can be wrong. And this court says, well, being in practice for 31 years, no prior discipline, no this, no that, no other, a public reprimand is good enough. Now, I'm not saying a public reprimand. And I wouldn't ask for a public reprimand because there were some serious issues regarding his IOLTA and some and these things. But if you take all those factors, as I said, if you take a look, this court does not automatically indefinitely suspend for an IOLTA violation or a fraud misconduct violation. You still look at the person, you look at their career, you look at what they have done or what they haven't done to determine how their future will be affected. And I submit, Your Honors, that the recommendation of the Board of Commissioners is the appropriate one under the facts of this case because they couldn't, Mr. Mishler, as the panel indicated, appears to be a riddle inside a mystery wrapped in an enigma. They couldn't figure him out.
That's a good way to end your argument. Thank
okay.
you, Potash.
Good enough, Your Honor.
Mr. Sasse, 30 seconds.
When you look at Mr. Mishler and his conduct in this case, the only appropriate sanction is an indefinite suspension. He never admitted what he did was wrong, and that is the real concern. He never admitted that he took money from his client and didn't give it back to him for several years. He never admitted entering into a settlement agreement without his client's permission, and you cannot have any possible assurance that he will not engage in such conduct again when he neither tried to give restitution nor admitted to these violations at any time prior to the institution of the disciplinary proceedings. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sasse. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.